One herd had only a single baby, their last hope for the future. And they called him Littlefoot.
Hey, cassettes, and welcome back to the BCD.
Welcome.
Energy.
Yes. Movement. Animation April is in full swing, and this week we're turning our attention to one of the most beloved animators of the 80s and 90s, Don Bluth.
Hey!
Don Bluth!
I don't know, I had my hand up, but I just felt right.
Yeah.
Yes, one of the greats we've mentioned a few times.
Mm-hmm. Right, very popular with millennials.
Yeah.
yeah, you're right.
Littlefoot, Fievel the Mouse, the heroic Mrs. Brisby. These familiar characters left a lasting impression when they made it to the big screen in the 1980s. In an era when the animation juggernaut, known as Walt Disney, was struggling to bring in viewers, these were the characters that carried on the tradition of beautifully crafted, hand-drawn animation. They captured the imagination of children and adults alike, and showcased the talent of Don Bluth, the creator behind such classics as The Secret of Nim and An American Tale. When Bluth and fellow animator Gary Goldman left Disney Animation Studios in the early 1980s, they sent waves through the film industry. Several talented animators followed Bluth and Goldman because they, too, were concerned about the direction in which Disney Animation was heading. When he founded his own studio, Bluth's goal was to create the kind of animation that Walt Disney himself would love, while also providing healthy competition to Bluth's former employer.
It's really interesting because you think, like, if he's trying to do Disney stuff, why leave
Disney?
Yeah.
But when you look at the difference between the movies that he does eventually put out versus what comes out from Disney at the same time, you can clearly see the difference.
Yeah. Yeah, he wanted to be able to take risks that Disney was not letting him take.
He wanted to be able to make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And Disney didn't want that anymore. They were like, we have a thing.
We have a process.
It's working.
We have a formula.
We require perfection for the investors. You know.
But this is just one part of Bluth's life and career. Today, we're taking a look at the animator's life and celebrating just some of the art that he has created so far. So fire up those VCRs and settle in, friends. It's time to learn about the life of Don Bluth.
Yeah!
So we're going to start out with some of his young life and family history
stuff.
Yay! Woohoo! Some pretty cool stuff, right? Don Bluth was born in El Paso, Texas on September 13, 1937, to Virgil and Emmeline Bluth. He has six siblings, one of which was Frederick Toby Bluth, who also had a successful career as an illustrator and animator. While living in Texas, the Bluth family attended El Paso's Congregation of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Bluth's connection to his faith continued to be an important part of his life and even impacted his career in animation. Don was highly imaginative, even from a young age. He loved to listen to the radio, specifically a Peabody Award-winning CBS program that featured retellings of classic fairy tales. He also loved to draw and would teach himself by copying comic book characters, but he never traced them. That's an important difference.
Yes, it is.
He covered the walls in his creations until his mother, Emmeline, saved up enough money to buy her son a drawing pad.
Yeah.
When Don was 7 years old, his family relocated to a farm in Utah. In order to afford the move, he and his brother, Bob, helped their mother sell pickled eggs. Interesting.
Yeah, they had a whole system.
Sorry, Don. Not for me.
No?
None for me, thanks.
Come on.
The family lived in Utah for several years, and it was there that Bluth fell in love with Disney animation. Every Saturday, he would ride his horse Flash 3 miles into town to watch movies. Bluth was entertained by movies like Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, Disney's first full-length animated movie that premiered only 99 days after Don Bluth was born. He would collect anything connected to the film, from dolls to comics, and keep them on his drawing desk at the farmhouse. It was also in these early years, playing on the farm, that Don experienced a seizure and was diagnosed with epilepsy. The doctor told him that it wasn't as severe as other cases, but the condition followed Don into adulthood. Because Don wasn't interested in playing sports like some of his brothers, he felt different and left out. His father was a police officer, and to Don, the epitome of what a man should be. But when Don saw a photo of Walt Disney for the first time, he was ecstatic. Here was his hero, someone who drew cartoons for a living, and he appeared to look manly as well.
The manliest of men. Exactly. Like when he was
Walt Disney.
I mean, when he was growing up, it was a big thing. Like, yeah. You know, have to be able to take care of a family and you know, you want to look man, you don't want to be the scrawny one, you know.
Yeah. Right.
It's just a big thing. And so he was kind of feeling left out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's always a conversation. Yep. About, you know, what's a man, you know?
Yeah.
What makes you manly?
I have no idea.
What makes a man?
Yes.
Yeah. Must be swift as the coursing river.
A man. Don practiced drawing every day. He didn't care much for the farm, and his dream was to leave and to work for his hero, Walt Disney. Whenever he created a drawing that he liked, he would display it on his desk until he no longer liked the way it looked. If he were to walk past the image with fresh eyes and found it well drawn, he would let it stay on display. But if he found the drawing lacking, he would create another one and start the process over. He continued this practice into adulthood, and has even said that the average lifespan of his drawings is only about 24 hours.
Dude.
Yeah.
Oh, God. I feel that. I'll start a thing and hate it immediately and just like, no. I won't even bother to continue. Like, no, just work on it more. It'll get there. No.
Hearing that, I thought about all of his movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I thought about all of his drawings and how often does he see that stuff and go, ah.
Oh, no. Oh.
Like, can he rewatch them?
Yeah. Like, oh, man. Yeah. Oh, I could do better than that. Oh, geez.
Or just, yeah, seeing one little mistake that you didn't catch the first time.
You can't do anything about.
The curse of being an artist.
Dude.
Right?
Dude. I dread the idea of you finish this movie, mm-hmm. you think you're like, oh, we did great job, and you see a mistake during the premiere, and you're just like, ah,
you kind of like look around, anyone else notice,
somebody his eyes change color for a moment,
yeah,
like, who did that? So,
in 1947, when Don Bluth was 10 years old, he started making original sketches based on the events and people that he saw in his town. For example, he borrowed his dad's Super 8 camera and recorded the image of a flying bird. He watched the footage over and over, attempting to animate its movements. It's exactly what Disney did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was in the early 1950s when Don was 15 years old that he had his first lesson in animation. Former Disney animator Wetzel Orson Judge Whitaker took a job at Brigham Young University to establish the BYU Motion Picture Studio. And Bluth took the opportunity to make an appointment with him. At one point in their meeting, Don asked the animator why he left Disney, and Whitaker explained that while he loved animating, he had come to a crossroads in his life, and he felt something was pulling him to the university. As Don Bluth recounts in his book Somewhere Out There, My Animated Life, he made a vow in front of Whitaker that once he made it to Disney's studio, he would never leave. To that, Whitaker quietly responded, "Perhaps. We'll see."
Oh.
Yeah.
15-year-old boy. And he's like, you know what?
Yeah.
You'll figure it out.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
At 17, Don and his father moved to Santa Monica, California, and were soon followed by the rest of the family. He graduated from Santa Monica High School. Funnily enough, this high school was where they filmed the James Dean classic Rebel Without a Cause.
Hey, nice.
Yeah. Although he wanted to become an animator as soon as possible, Don's parents insisted that he attend college. Ugh, parents.
Ugh.
So he returned to Utah and enrolled in Brigham Young University.
College.
Yep. College.
While attending BYU as a freshman, Bluth called up Judge Whitaker, who offered him a job operating the animation camera in the motion picture studio. Whitaker told Bluth that it was obvious that he was meant to be an animator and to drop him a postcard once he was hired at Walt Disney.
Oh, isn't that really sweet?
That is nice.
That is so nice.
He's so believed in him.
Yeah.
He's like, you're going to do it.
You're going to do it. You got this.
Yeah, you're not going to stay there, but you're going to do it.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't mean to say that part out loud.
But like, yeah.
You won't stay. Don struck up a deal with his parents. If he got good grades, he could apply to work at Disney. Luckily for Don, his parents accepted a B in his English class as an acceptable grade and upheld their end of the bargain. In June of 1956, when Don Bluth was just 18 years old, he began working at Walt Disney Productions.
Hell yeah, dude. Bees.
Yes.
That's my man.
That's right.
Right in my wheelhouse. I can work at Disney too, everybody.
But yeah, so that was like that was his early life. Mm-hmm. That was like, you know, just growing up, the beginnings, the early
yes.
days.
Yep. Milking the cows early in the morning. It's so many chores to do. That kind of a life.
Mm. It's really cool to see somebody who had like a passion for something so early.
Yeah.
And like pursued it all the way to the end and like did it. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because we all have ambitions as kids. You know, the stereotypical, oh, I want to be a firefighter. I want to be an astronaut. I want to be a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And then how many people get that far? You know, some do.
Yeah.
But it is always cool to see when it really does happen, especially if it's something like this, like an animator, somebody to do cartoons. Like that's not like a crazy kid's dream, you know?
Yeah.
So.
My God.
Yeah. You imagine like being 18 and having your dream job.
Dude.
I mean, wild.
Insane. Wow. That would be cool.
So let's talk about his first projects and his eventual split from Disney.
Woo-hoo. Yeah.
Because spoilers, he didn't stay. At Disney.
Yeah.
If
you've been listening to our show for long enough, you would know that.
Don Bluth started his animation career as an in-betweener. An in-betweener creates the frames in between the extremes of an action drawn by the animator. Their role is key in making animation appear smooth and seamless. Bluth's first film credit at Disney was Sleeping Beauty in 1959.
Nice. Good one.
It's pretty cool.
See, I knew I liked Don Bluth.
Yeah, it's Marcy's favorite.
It's a good movie.
That was my mom's favorite, too.
Oh.
Within his first 6 months at Disney, Don was promoted to assistant animator and began an apprenticeship under John Lounsbery. Lounsbery was one of the famed Nine Old Men, the group of senior animators that famously ran Walt Disney Productions' animation department. Lounsbery directed The Rescuers and The Many Adventures of Winnie the Pooh just before his death in 1976. Both of those films were released the following year in 1977. He was the first of the Nine Old Men to die, and the group dissolved.
Oh,
damn. That's a bummer.
Yeah. So this is something I don't think we've talked very much about. Mm-hmm. So at Disney, there was this group of guys, and they were kind of like this, just the senior animators, mm-hmm. and they were called the Nine Old Men, because that's what FDR called the Supreme Court.
Ah, amazing.
Yeah, so that's what they were like, the court of Disney animation.
The council.
Yes.
Yeah. Whenever I hear about this group, I'm just like, dang, how much knowledge were they able to pass and how much is lost, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just like, dang, they, like, masters of the craft, you know? Just incredible. Because I've seen, like, interviews and stuff with more recent animators or people who are working on later movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who are like, they go back and they'll look at the water they animated for this movie. And they're like, damn, how did they do it? How
did they do it?
And they can't crack the code because they're not around anymore. Yeah. That's why I do hope that one day that we still see some hand-drawn animated stuff.
Yeah.
Because I want to see what it would look like now. Because it's definitely not going to be a perfect recreation of the past. But I do want to see it.
Yeah. And like, because we really could. I mean, it could get better. About 2 years into his animation career, Bluth was presented with a crossroads. He was called on a mission by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and asked to live for 2.5 years in Argentina.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Bluth accepted the mission and left his dream job. According to Bluth, he was not allowed to communicate with anyone from home while he was on the trip, and he had to learn Spanish while living in Argentina. At first, he regretted the decision to leave, but now he believes that leaving animation and gaining that experience is what helped him strike out on his own later on and create films under his own name.
What?
Yeah.
Why?
He went on a mission.
Yeah.
Yeah.
His faith was like super important to him.
I guess so. Yeah, man. I don't know if I could do that.
Yeah. His pastor or his bishop or something asked him directly, like, hey, are you going to go on a mission? And he like basically ended up not being able to say no. Not because he didn't. Because he wanted to say no. Uh-huh. It was kind of like, well, why don't I? What's stopping me from doing that? Like, yeah, it's scary to leave Disney, my dream job. But he's like, this is also important to me. And which am I going to choose first? Like, do I love God more or do I love animation more?
Yeah.
So
interesting.
That was his crossroads.
Yeah. The part that really gets me, though, is not being able to contact anyone.
I know.
Yeah.
Wow.
I don't.
So lonely.
Just like, just live a completely new, different life for 2.5 years.
And learning a new language. Like,
yikes,
oh my
dude.
Gosh.
It's so hard.
Yeah.
It's difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just, but I do think, I mean, I think he's right.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine if he had stayed at Disney all that time.
Yeah.
Yep. And that, you know, from 18 on, basically building from the ground up, like a bona fide Disney animator, you know?
Yep.
Do you think he ever would have left? Do you think
That's a good point.
If he had just stayed there forever.
Yeah.
It would be 14 years before Don Bluth would return to Disney full time. After completing his mission, he resumed his education at Brigham Young University and earned a degree in English literature. After that, Bluth returned to animation, taking summer jobs at Disney. In the late 1960s, Bluth became a layout artist for Filmation Inc., a studio known for producing many popular Saturday morning cartoons like The Archie Show and He-Man and Masters of the Universe.
Yeah.
Nice. Good stuff.
In 1970, Don Bluth returned to Walt Disney Productions. He noticed remarkable differences in the culture and attitude since the death of Walt Disney. He felt that the studio was more focused on efficiency, and he was seen simply as an employee and nothing more.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sounds familiar.
You know, we've heard his perspective of what Disney was
like.
Yeah. And there are differing perspectives.
Mm-hmm. Bluth worked at Disney for several years on projects like Robin Hood and The Rescuers. At this time, the studio had entered into what film historians would later call the Bronze Age, or Disney's Dark Age. The studio started employing cost-cutting techniques, like reusing animation from other films. For example, Wooly Reitherman, one of the Nine Old Men, instructed Bluth to use the animation of Snow White dancing in 1937 and apply it to Maid Marian in Robin Hood. If you play the footage back-to-back, the recycled animation is obvious. This concept was used in several Bronze Age films.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's all over, man.
It is. It's... Adam and I watched all of the Disney animated classics.
Yep.
And when you watch all of them like we did in kind of a short period of time, you really see this stuff.
Yeah.
You really see
all of it.
Yeah.
Recycled.
Yeah.
And there's nothing, I don't think there's really anything wrong with it. When people pull those images online and, you know, match them up. Like,
Yeah.
A lot of them from Robin Hood.
That's what Don Bluth's take on it is he said he was often called, like, people would say, like, oh, you're cheating, mm-hmm. that's cheating. And he didn't really agree with that. He actually was kind of glad that he got to do that because he got to learn the movements and stuff. So it's kind of like he was relearning what the Nine Old Men had already learned, but he was learning it himself by doing the same thing.
Yeah.
So. One of the biggest things that, like, before I knew that they were reusing animations, one of the biggest things to kind of give it away was how Little John in Robin Hood is just the spitting image of Baloo.
I mean, exactly the same.
I mean, I always thought it's like Baloo is acting in this movie.
Yes.
Like, they hired Baloo to play Little John
play
in this movie. Like, you know what I mean? That's what
that's
it feels
funny.
Like.
A little universe.
It is what it feels like.
Because it's not only the exact same bear character, but the same voice, too.
I know, same voice actor.
So it's like, So, and then on top of that, yeah, the animation movements and stuff are.
Yeah. In the late 1970s, after the passing of John Lounsbery, the nine old men began to retire from the studio. With them, they took a lot of knowledge and experience that hadn't been passed down to the next generation of leaders. At this time, Don Bluth became close with fellow animators Gary Goldman and John Pomeroy. The three of them decided that in order to get directing experience, they should try to make their own half-hour animated film. At Disney, Don was directing a 26-minute animated film called The Small One, which was based off of a 1947 book by Charles Tazewell. Don was told that there was no money in the budget for songs and that his team of animators would be a group of trainees. Animator Wooly Reitherman was unhappy with the final project, and according to Don, word spread that he was unable to produce a quality Disney film.
Yikes.
One of the absolute staples of Disney films is songs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hello?
Not being able to do songs. Mm-mm. I remember reading, too, that he was kind of relieved. Yes. Like, word spread that he was a bad director, and he was kind of like, whew, okay.
All right.
I could just go back to animating.
Oh, yeah. Nobody has to see that?
Yeah.
I don't need
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, but they were like, no.
No, you get to try again.
Yeah, you get to try again.
Why don't you just, what?
In the hours after work, Don Bluth, Gary Goldman, and John Pomeroy began working on Banjo the Woodpile Cat, a half-hour feature that was independent of Disney. They bought their own equipment and set up in Bluth's garage. The team spent their nights experimenting with animation and trying to rediscover some of the techniques that had been lost over the last few years. When some other Disney animators heard about the project, they joined the team, and after 4 years, the film was complete. Don Bluth took out a second mortgage to pay for the voice actors and composer.
Oh my goodness gracious.
He believed in it, man.
Yeah. Dude, that is so interesting. I guess I'm kind of guilty of it too, because I do what I essentially do for work at home pretty often. But like dedicating the amount of time and effort with all these people, that's crazy. Because I would think that going home is like the last thing I want to do is draw more.
And I think people were just so excited to get to work on something a little outside of the box, of what they were working on in Disney. And so then, you know, they heard, oh my gosh, you're relearning how to draw that. You're relearning, you know, because these tricks of the trade had been lost.
Yeah.
And it was like, well, how are we going to learn them again? Like, we're going to have to experiment.
Exactly.
We have to
make mistakes.
Yeah.
Yes. Also, Banjo the Woodpile Cat was based off of a cat that he had known back in his farm days. So I thought that's really cute.
Nice. I also like to think that somebody along the way suggested that they call themselves the Woodpile Cats Club. Because that just, I want to, like,
that would be super
cool.
Cute.
That does
put that
cool.
up on the wall or something.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh my gosh. And I saw on IMDb that his brother, Toby, was credited with writing this with him.
Oh
cool.
Yeah.
That's really cool. What might have started out as a side project to gain more animation experience turned into an example of the work that Bluth and other Disney animators could accomplish on their own. The project reportedly caused divisions at Disney, and some would see it as proof that Don Bluth poached Disney's animators.
You watched that documentary
where
they talk about it, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was Waking Sleeping Beauty.
Mm-hmm.
And they like come out and write, they're just like, Don Bluth just wanted to be another Disney, and he just took all of our people and stuff.
Yeah,
and they made him sound just like a complete villain.
Yeah.
Like as if there was nothing of worth, nothing good about him having been at Disney or anything.
Yeah.
Nope.
I know, it's such a fascinating thing because, he historically clashed with a lot of up-and-coming animators that became really famous.
Yeah.
Famous in the animation world from Disney. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of those up-and-coming people like Brad Bird and John Lasseter and those, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, they definitely had different ideas.
as to what they wanted.
Yeah, and they clashed in those ways.
Banjo the Woodpile Cat was completed in 1979, and in that same year, Don Bluth and Gary Goldman left Walt Disney Productions. Over a dozen animators followed them in an event that we refer to as the Disney Exodus. At the time, Disney wasn't performing very well commercially, and because there were few rival studios producing animated films, audiences began to question the longevity of the art form. Part of Bluth's plan was to give Disney some healthy competition and revive the magic of hand-drawn animation. Bluth formed Don Bluth Productions, and the studio began working on their first feature film, The Secret of Nim. If you would like to learn more about the Disney Exodus, we have an entire episode on it.
So yes,
go back
do.
And listen to that. So now, since we've talked about the Disney Exodus a little bit, mm-hmm. we've talked about his life.
Yeah.
Now we're going to talk about a few of his most influential movies.
Yay! The movies!
The movies! What y'all came here for, right?
That's what we talk about here.
The first full-length animated movie to come from Don Bluth Productions was The Secret of Nim, a film that was visually and tonally darker than anything being produced at Disney. The film was based on a book called Mrs. Frisbee and the Rats of Nim. The film follows Mrs. Frisbee, a heroic mother mouse, who must find a way to save her young ailing child from the frost and from the farmer's plow. In order to get help, she appeals to the Rats of Nim, a group of rodents with advanced intelligence due to scientific experiments. In order to animate well, reference models and sometimes live-action films were made to get movements right. Mr. Age's lab was inspired by an old abandoned threshing machine on the farm that Don used to play in as a child. Don's father was kind enough to go out and take pictures of the inside of it as a reference model for the movie. That's so sweet. Yeah.
Mr. Yeah. Age's is this character in the movie who's kind of, he's the wise old mouse.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of like a doctor character.
Yes. In one scene, a cow is dragged out of the mud. In order to get reference footage, the team tranquilized the cow to be calmer, put her in mud, and pulled her out.
Oh.
Yeah. Don made sure that someone looked after the cow's welfare because he had a soft spot for the animals after growing up on a farm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And someone should always look out for the
exactly.
animal's welfare.
Mm-hmm. And it was really sweet because he could tell that the cow was pregnant.
Oh.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so he called out to one of the men, like, around, and he's like, hey, what's your name? Mm-hmm. And the guy was like, Clifford. And he's like, okay, Clifford, the cow's baby's name is going to be Clifford, and you are going to make sure that this mom, this baby cow makes it to life.
Yeah.
Along with its mother. And so, yeah.
Nice.
It was really sweet.
Give her extra carrots or
yeah.
whatever it is cow's like.
The Secret of Nim was a turning point in animation history. Although the film was not commercially successful, it proved to critics that a small, independent studio was capable of creating animated feature films that rivaled Disney in quality. It also was one of the first animated films to use a celebrity's voice for a character. Dom DeLuise voiced Jeremy the Crow and would give his voice in several other Don Bluth productions. Yeah, we've talked about this,
I
for
sure. I have such mixed feelings on that, man.
It's not like it was the first ever time.
Yeah.
Right.
But it was kind of, at the time, everybody was critical of the choice. Mm-hmm. Everybody was like, oh, there's no way we're going to be taken out of this.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no way we're going to be able to, like,
not
actually believe
yeah.
that this is a crow and not Dom DeLuise.
Yeah.
Because his voice is distinctive and we know who he is.
Yep.
And that was, like, that's what everyone was saying. And then it was successful. And then it was just kind of like, oh, actually.
Yeah.
I can totally
it can work.
Suspend my
it
disbelief.
Yeah.
If I had actually been near a cat, I'd be sneezing my brains out. See, I'm allergic to hair. I'm allergic to hay. I'm allergic to hair.
Bluth's studio faced bankruptcy after Nim, but producer Morris Sullivan decided to invest in Bluth's movies. Together, they formed Sullivan Bluth Studios.
Yeah, and that's what it was known as until it folded.
Yes.
Yeah.
I do sometimes wish, like, what if we could go to a timeline where instead of Illumination,
yeah.
we still had Sullivan Bluth Studios around.
Yeah.
So you have, you know, you'd have Disney, DreamWorks, Sullivan Bluth,
yeah.
Blue Sky.
Blue Sky, yeah.
Next, we're going to talk about An American Tale.
Aww. Somewhere out there.
Yes. For his next animated feature, Don Bluth teamed up with Steven Spielberg.
Hey.
Yes. Who also had a passion for animation. Together, they made An American Tale, the highest grossing non-Disney animated film at the time. It even beat Disney's current release, The Great Mouse Detective.
Wow.
What?
Which is a pretty good movie, yeah, by the way.
Yes, it is. Spielberg wanted to collaborate with Don Bluth on an animated film, and in 1984, he contacted Bluth to tell him that he had found the perfect story for the film. When Sullivan Bluth met with Spielberg, he laid out the story, which is credited to David Kirshner of Hocus Pocus writing fame. Spielberg said in their meeting, "It's about a young mouse named Mousy Mouskowitz and his family who immigrate from Russia to the United States by boat after their home is destroyed by cats. During the trip, a fierce storm throws little Mousy overboard and he loses contact with his family. The story will be his journey to find them again. It'll be a musical, and it will be called An American Tale, spelled T-A-I-L, not T-A-L-E.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh my gosh, this movie is so cute.
It really is.
Yeah, and that's the thing, like, Secret of Nim, I love Secret of Nim, it is, but it is tonally very dark.
Yeah.
And this one is also pretty dark.
Yeah, it's got some dark scenes.
But it's definitely a little more lighthearted because it has, like, the musical element to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, which Secret of Nim doesn't.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
And it's a child main character.
Yeah. Yes. It's got this very cute family dynamic.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. And when he gets lost, it's like, oh, my God.
No, I know. Gosh, the whole scene of the storm is
awful. So hard. It's so hard to watch.
Judy Freiberg and Tony Geis wrote the screenplay for this film. Next, my personal favorite, The Land Before Time.
I wonder why it's his favorite.
Yeah.
Nobody will ever know. Discussions about the next film collaboration between Amblin and Sullivan Bluth started during the production of An American Tale. For this next feature, Spielberg tapped into another one of his interests, dinosaurs.
Dinosaur.
What?
They workshopped the idea that the film would be like Bambi, the story of a young child that faces a huge loss and must rely on his friends as he faces the challenges of growing up. But instead of forest animals, the story would feature dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that Bambi is such a basic story that everybody's like, oh, it's Bambi, but with blank.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's Bambi, but with dinosaurs. Oh, it's Bambi, but with lions, you know?
Yeah.
Trauma.
Just, the basic, exactly.
Trauma.
It's the basic hero's journey, you know, with animals. Trauma, then you have to go on some sort of growing up adventure.
Yep.
The Land Before Time follows the story of Littlefoot, a young dinosaur that must find his way to the Great Valley and be reunited with others of his kind. After the death of his mother, Littlefoot is on his own, but he finds a group of friends that join him on his journey.
Aww.
And what a group of friends they are.
Yeah.
Aren't they just the cutest?
Bunch of scallywags.
Oh my gosh, they're adorable. Yeah.
Tony Geis and Judy Freiberg returned to write the screenplay for this film as well. It was the only Don Bluth film of the 1980s not to feature the voice of Dom DeLuise, as he was acting in Disney's Oliver and Company instead. What
Dom?
Dom.
Traitor.
Oh, man. Of all the other movies.
He's great in that movie, too.
Yeah.
He is. Originally titled The Land Before Time Began, the film was originally intended to be dialogue-free. Bluth, Spielberg, and George Lucas, who joined as a producer, ultimately decided that there would need to be voice actors to draw in young audiences. Even the earliest plot lines of the movie included themes of prejudice, as the dinosaurs have difficulty getting along across their species.
Yeah.
Ah, yeah. Yes, that's right.
It's a big part of it's a big part of the movie.
And right from the beginning, it's really interesting, kind of like depiction of how it goes in real life sometimes, where Littlefoot and Sarah meet
kind of on their own, and they're like, oh, we'll play.
Yeah.
And it's fine.
Yeah.
And Sarah's a little rough and tumble still, yeah, but, you know, they get along well enough.
Yeah.
And then the parents step in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, three horns don't play with long necks. It's like, okay, Dad.
Wow.
The parents are like, oh, no. Oh, God, no, we failed. We didn't pass our hatred down. Yeah. Oh, no. We're going to have to, we have to fix this.
Oh, shit. Yeah. It was during this film's production that Sullivan Bluth moved to Ireland, where it would stay until it dissolved in the late 1990s. The move pushed production back by several months, and it was released in November of 1988, incidentally on the same day as Oliver and Company.
Oh my God.
What?
For goodness sakes. These of two
direct competition.
Yeah,
they're like, you know, these studios are in a boxing ring together. Right. They're directly duking it out, man. The film was a commercial success and led to a series of straight-to-video sequels. Of all the films, the first Land Before Time is the only one that isn't a musical.
Yep.
Which is pretty cool.
Yeah, it is pretty cool.
Yep.
Not that I don't like all of the songs from the later movies, because they're fun. But this one, I think it is better off without music or songs, because it needed to take itself somewhat seriously,
right, just because
of the subject matter and things like that. So
I know, it's a Don Bluth. It's an 80s Don Bluth movie.
Yeah.
So it's like pretty serious.
Yeah.
I feel like, you know, even just mentioning it sometimes mm-hmm. can bring some grown up kids to tears.
Yeah.
You know, children that watched it.
For real.
You know, this is a really touching movie.
Yeah. And I can't imagine a time throughout the movie, like, there's no moment where I see the characters are just, I'm going to start singing now. Don Bluth said about the film in his autobiography, "I'll be with you always" is what Littlefoot's mom says. He believes life does not end when you die. You'll be together again with your family.
Yeah. I wanted to say, because you know how you were saying, what if Don Bluth stuck around? Mm. Like, what if Sullivan Bluth was still a thing?
Yeah.
So I think that if Steven Spielberg had not tried to make Amblimation and continued to make movies with Don Bluth, then Sullivan Bluth would have stuck around.
Yeah.
And I think that the trade-off would be that there would be no DreamWorks.
Oh, yeah.
Because without Amblimation, there never would have been DreamWorks.
Interesting.
Snap. That's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that would have been the ripple effect. Because Steven Spielberg decided to do his own stuff.
Yeah.
Because, you know, him and Don Bluth, they got along, but they liked doing
their
own thing.
Yeah, their own stuff, yeah.
And so he did Amblimation, made three movies.
Interesting.
And then he formed DreamWorks.
We may not have had
How
to Train Your Dragon.
I was going to say, I think as much as I like Land Before Time and I love these Don Bluth movies, I don't think I would take the trade because How to Train Your Dragon is one of the best animated trilogies ever made.
Yeah.
I love Kung Fu Panda. Shrek revolutionized like what it means to be a fairy tale animated movie. It kind of changed the game. It wouldn't be the same without DreamWorks.
Yeah.
Dude, that's a really interesting thought. And actually, if you're listening, the people listening right now, let us know if you'd take that trade, because I'm really curious what other people think.
All Dogs Go to Heaven is the next one we're going to talk about. All Dogs Go to Heaven follows a German shepherd named Charlie who was betrayed and killed by a casino owner. Whew, starting out strong, Don Bluth.
Yikes.
A little bit dark.
In order to return to Earth, he snags a magical watch that gives him more time. He plans to use this time to get revenge, but instead begins to care for an orphan girl that he is using to gain that revenge. Don Bluth had the idea for this film after completing work on The Secret of NIMH. He recalled a fourth grade middle school teacher that had read the class a story. The story was of a little girl whose life was saved by a dog. The pair eventually ended up together, reunited after death for all eternity. When Don finally found the book that she had read from, there was no story like this. only an anthology of other stories. He's like, brain just created that story.
Either his brain or he was like, maybe she just made one up. You know, sometimes, you know, when you have a little kid and there's too many words in the book, you just kind of, you look at the pictures and you make up your own story for it.
That's true.
That totally could have happened.
Do you think this character had to deal with hobbies at any point?
That's probably the little girl. They kept the name of the book, which was All Dogs Go to Heaven, and made their own story. Dawn said, I didn't want to change the title because I love how provocative it sounds. And I love how people respond to the title alone. People really do respond to it.
Yeah.
It's true, don't they?
Yeah.
And actually, I've heard it and said it as just a phrase.
Yeah.
It's like, this is a truth.
It's true.
Yeah. All dogs go to heaven because they're so...
Yeah.
Dogs are wonderful.
The writers drew inspiration from movies such as It's a Wonderful Life, Little Miss Marker, and A Guy Named Joe.
Very cool.
The protagonist, a German shepherd named Charlie, was modeled after a scruffy German shepherd that Gary Goldman found in the LA River and brought with him to Dublin.
Wow, jeez.
That's pretty cool.
He named him Bert, and he became the perfect model for Charlie. The story went through several changes as Don Bluth was not happy about the convoluted script that was given to them by a Hollywood writer. The story was finally fleshed out after Don talked about their latest film with Robert Towne. Towne listened to the story, went to the restroom, and then came out with a simplified version of the story for Don. Years after that, Don would retreat into the bathroom to try for similar epiphanies.
That's hilarious.
I mean, it's like, hey, you know what?
Yeah, that worked that one time.
You just give your noodle a little time to think about it.
Yeah.
It's like having a brain blast.
Just
like manifest.
David N. Weiss rewrote the script with the help of the producers, working on the script from October to December of 1987. When recording the stars' voices began, they had high hopes for Burt Reynolds. When they saw that the script in his hand was dog-eared and rolled up, they thought it was a good sign. However, when Burt began recording, he gave a higher-pitched voice, what he thought a dog would sound like. They convinced him to record it with both the high-pitched voice and his regular voice. But luckily, Dom DeLuise had the directors record the pair together, and the magic and friendship really came along.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah,
Dom was like, put me in the same room with him. I'll straighten him out. I'll get him to do the right kind of voice. Yeah. I'll get him to be Bert.
Yeah.
Came back after Oliver and Company. He's like, damn, I missed out on Land Before Time. I guess I'll get the next one. I'm back.
I think it's funny and cute that the dog that Gary found, he named it Bert. And then the character Charlie was voiced by Bert Reynolds.
Yeah.
Oh, that is funny.
Oh my God.
Coincidence.
During this time, Roy Disney Jr. wanted to meet up with Don. They met at a pub in Cork. After exchanging pleasantries and compliments, Roy offered for Don to come back to Disney, where, quote, all would be forgiven. Don replied, honestly, Roy, I think not. You need someone like us to push you. We make Disney Studio try harder. Face it, you've gotten better because of us. Roy then replied, saying that Don could not win this and that Disney would crush them.
Damn, Roy, what the hell?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so rude.
All would be forgiven, huh?
All would be forgiven.
Interesting. How would the other animators feel if you brought Don Bluth back?
Yeah.
So he talked a bit about it. He said that because all the other animators knew that he was meeting with Roy.
Right.
And they were all like, okay, don't screw up. Don't fuck up. Like, go, you know, maybe you could get us all back or like something of that sort.
Uh-huh.
And he went and his impression that it was only an offer for him.
Right.
So he turned it down flat because he's like, all these people have moved to Dublin and stuff.
Yeah.
For me, he's like, I can't abandon them when we're like in the middle of producing another film. Like, he's just like, I can't do that. And so he turned Roy down flat. But when he went and he told the other animators about it, apparently they were not happy with him.
Mm.
They were like, you should have talked to us before you just turned it down flat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I don't quite understand, but
yeah,
I don't know.
I mean, maybe they had doubts in the movies, like maybe since Spielberg dropped out, they were just like, maybe I'm not so confident anymore.
They also just couldn't believe that he said that to Roy. They were like, you said that? Like,
to Roy Disney?
To Roy Disney? Okay.
I mean, but is he wrong, though?
I don't think so.
I mean, yeah, I think that the competition really did help.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I don't think we would have had the Disney Renaissance had they not. Because they would have been, you know, basically content in their corporate ways.
Yep, exactly.
And... you know, we wouldn't have the amazing movies that we have.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The next movie is Thumbelina. Aww. Thumbelina is a young woman who was born in a flower and is only a couple of inches tall. Although she leads a happy life, she worries that she will never meet someone her own size. That is, until she sees Prince Cornelius of the fairies. The couple falls in love, and all seems well until Thumbelina is kidnapped and nearly forced to marry someone else. Thumbelina must escape and find her way back to the prince.
My goodness.
Oh, man.
I loved this movie. I watched this a lot when I was a kid.
Oh.
I did. I watched this. My sister Rachel loved it. Jodie Benson played Thumbelina.
Very nice. Of
Little Mermaid. Yeah. Yep. Thumbelina is based on the story by Hans Christian Andersen. In the film Hans Christian Andersen from 1952, Danny Kaye as Hans sings, "Thumbelina, Thumbelina, though you're very small, when your heart is full of love, you're 9 feet tall." Don loves this quote and believes it perfectly states what Thumbelina is about. He wanted girls to love the character and be inspired by her. They hired Carol Lynn Pearson, a poet and author, to draft up a script. They gave her 9 months to finish. She returned with a script that portrayed Thumbelina as a role model who was not waiting for a prince. When her completed draft came in at about the 8th month, Dom was excited for it. After reading it, however, he felt that a few things needed changing. He gave Carol Lynn notes on what he thought should be improved. He felt that the prince was too wimpy and that Thumbelina had a pessimistic view of the world. She agreed to take it back and think about his notes, but when they met again, she was adamant that her story was solid and did not need rewrites. Don flew back to Dublin, furiously trying to rewrite as they needed to begin working on it soon. Years after he read something she had written that made him understand her point of view, she said, "Issues are more important to me than art itself."
I was a little unclear, one, on that quote, how it brought clarity to him. And I was also unclear as to whether he kept her version or if he ended up, I mean, I think he did change it.
Yeah.
And use the changes in the film is what it sounded like.
Based on the final product. Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, in her version, she believes that the issues are more important than the art. So it's like you have to tell the story a certain way, even though it doesn't like fit the mold.
Yeah. Mm.
Don handed over the character design for this film to Roland Wilson. Don described Roland's creations of the characters as the tender, loving care of a toy maker. Betty White recorded for the part of Miss Fieldmouse, but Don felt that it wasn't quite right. Though he was a big fan of Betty's, he had Carol Channing also come in and record the lines. His mistake was not telling Betty that he was going to do this. Betty found out from Carol that she had recorded for this mouse, and Don heard from lawyers shortly after. He felt terrible and could only send a heartfelt apology in the mail.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Yep, because Carol called her up and was like, "Hey, I recorded
this was
a
fun
part, and it was really fun and cute." Yeah,
yeah, I would be pissed, too.
And Betty was like, "Oh,
that's
odd, because I just did the same thing.
I did the exact same thing."
Yeah, so.
Interesting. Yep.
And he felt pretty bad about it and was like, "Yeah, I messed up."
I kind of want to hear Betty White's version.
Yeah.
He was like, "She must have just been having an off day or something." But maybe it just wasn't.
Please.
Maybe
Betty
White. I know, right? That's what I was thinking.
I don't think so.
I was like, I think he just wanted a different sounding voice for the part.
Yeah.
But
Yeah. Thumbelina came out just months before The Lion King in 1994.
Oh, boy.
Ooh.
Talk about a knockout punch.
Yeah. This was one of the last films made by Sullivan Bluth. The studio suffered financially, and its last feature, Pebble the Penguin, was a critical and financial flop. Sullivan Bluth closed in 1995. But Bluth's directing days were not over.
Yeah, I don't hear great things about
Pebble the Penguin.
Yeah.
I have not seen that
one. Well, it is interesting because when Pebble was coming out, they had all of it done pretty much. And they got overtaken by, I believe, MGM.
Yeah.
And in the contract, when MGM was taking them, they were like, okay, we'll take on these movies and we'll release them, but we are going to edit the Penguin movie.
Mm.
So
okay.
Bluth and his people were not able to edit it. So
oh my God.
I feel like that's not probably a little bit of why.
Yeah.
Because they probably had a vision for it and they didn't get to complete it the way they wanted. It was edited by totally different people that had no idea.
That's exactly why.
Yeah.
Editing makes movies.
Yep.
It really does.
Yeah.
Yep.
Editing is everything.
It really is.
It is. Yeah.
The last one we are going to talk about is Anastasia. And no, it is not a Disney movie.
Nope.
20th Century Fox tapped Don Bluth and Gary Goldman to direct their latest animated film. Bill Mechanic, CEO of 20th Century Fox, wanted a rags-to-riches story, and he wanted Don's team to make it. In an early meeting, Bill told Gary and Don of Anastasia, a Russian Romanov princess that allegedly may have escaped the execution of her family. Many Anastasias turned up over the years. One in particular was Anna Anderson, who insisted that she was the young princess. While Gary was enthralled and had many questions, Don was skeptical and felt that it was too dark for a princess movie. He could only think that she died that fateful night in 1918. Bill was confident in the story and gave the overarching ideas for the film. He told Gary and Don to read Anna Anderson's book to get the imagination flowing.
What an interesting movie topic.
Yeah.
It truly is.
This is so, it's so unique. Because it's like there's elements of truth.
Yeah.
And then elements of fiction.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, it's like, oh, it really is this romanticized, well, what if she did survive?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
I love this movie.
Yeah.
But when you watch it with a child for the first time and they have questions,
yeah,
it is hard to answer those questions.
Yeah.
Because she's got a family in the beginning.
Yeah.
Which she hardly see. They hardly show the family because
they probably don't want too much.
They don't want you to be attached to them.
Yep.
And then some scary things happen. And then, boom, she's just an orphan.
Yep.
And I remember, you know, as the movie was going on, like my niece, I watched it with her. Mm-hmm. And she was like, well, what happened to her family?
Yeah.
What happened? Mm-hmm. The massacre of an entire family is pretty intense for a G-rated animated film.
Yeah, it truly is.
Yeah.
And we've talked before about how animation can do these things. And
it is a
medium and not a genre.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But this is directed at children.
It was aimed
at a younger audience in the vein of Disney, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, this time around, maybe not the best move.
That's the thing is that like I love it. I love this movie, and as an adult,
and
I'll watch it.
The villain too.
Yeah,
it's like he's so entertaining.
As a kid, I totally didn't really question it very much.
Yeah,
they began by actually shooting a start to finish live action version. He had not publicly admitted this until his biography book. But as beautiful as the animation was, Don prefers the live-action version. It is stored in a temperature-controlled vault somewhere, so we probably will never see it.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, my God.
He's
that's
surprisingly
crazy.
Like, yeah, I don't know.
Dude, come on. Let that let
I
kinda
it
out.
I
kind of want
to see that.
I know, right?
I mean, I don't love the idea, but business-wise, I think it makes sense to, like, kind of claim the movie.
Yeah.
Disney could re-release it.
Mm-hmm.
On Blu-ray, like Steelbook special edition.
Yeah.
With the live action shit included.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That would be wild.
That would be so crazy.
I almost couldn't pass it up.
I know. I was about to say, sadly, I might actually buy
you know
this
what I
if
mean?
They did that.
Just to see that? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don drew hundreds of Anastasias to get her right. And as for the script, It was mostly fleshed out by Eric Tuchman, but many people worked on it, including Carrie Fisher.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Wow, nice.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It kind of makes you think about all the biting remarks and the banter between the characters.
Yes.
The insults. And...
Mm-hmm. The two leads of the film were Meg Ryan and John Cusack. Dawn had enjoyed Sleepless in Seattle and thought that she would have the right amount of sass and vulnerability as Anastasia. In order to convince Bill Mechanic that she was the right choice, they made an animated test that used a snippet of her voice from Sleepless in Seattle. John Cusack was perfect for Dimitri, as he had a lot of energy and was a fantastic actor. When put in the sound booth together, they had a great back and forth exchange. Dimitri was also almost Johnny Depp, but he turned it down. And Robert Downey Jr. was also reportedly considered for the role, but his reputation wasn't quite what the studio wanted at the time.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Oh, they're wild.
Yeah, man.
It was wild. It was more they were worried about how it would do financially,
mm-hmm.
especially because they're not as big. Yeah, they just wanted to make sure they got enough money back. The film was a financial success, and many people even mistook it for a Disney movie.
Which is so funny to me.
Yeah. Yep.
It's so funny.
Even with the 20th She's Century one of the princesses. Fox.
Yeah.
You know, even yeah. with the great, big, oh loud, gosh, gold yeah. 20th Century Fox logo
Doesn't
that comes up.
Matter. Yep.
Nah, Disney did it. In 2023, Don Bluth released his autobiography entitled Somewhere Out There, My Animated Life. It recounts many stories about his life and career that we didn't cover today. So if you're interested in learning more, check it out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
It was a large source for this episode.
It really was.
It's really cool getting some firsthand stuff.
Yes.
Recently, Don Bluth formed Don Bluth Studios, LLC. According to the business website, his goal is to create new characters and stories that will start as children's books and will later be pitched as TV shows. This is a collaboration with Lavelle Lee from traditionalanimation.com. Their goal is to start a hand-drawn animation renaissance.
Yeah.
Please.
Woo! Do you think it can happen?
I hope so.
To be honest, I think it can, but I don't know if it's going to be them. To do it. They might be able to contribute, but I think somebody else might have to break the ice, to be honest. And we might see it. I mean, there are movies out there changing up styles. I think like Spider-Verse is really shaking things up. So I think it's possible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we will see. I really hope that it happens.
Yeah.
Now we're going to talk a little bit about some of the awards that he's won over the course of his life. Don was awarded the Time Machine Honorary Award in 1993 at the Catalonian International Film Festival. He was also awarded a Winsor McKay Award in 2005 at the Annies.
Oh, that's nice.
Very cool.
If you're familiar with Winsor McKay, if you're not familiar with Winsor McKay, he was a super influential animator in the very early days.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
His films have garnered a few wins, such as Anastasia, with a Critics' Choice Award for Best Family Film, and An American Tale, with a Song of the Year at the Grammys.
I know, that's so cool.
That's
pretty awesome. Others were nominated, such as Land Before Time, for a Saturn Award for Best Fantasy Film, but lost to Who Framed Roger Rabbit that year.
Yeah, I mean, that's tough competition.
Darn it, but I mean, Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
I mean,
yeah, it was pretty big.
Freaking great. Yeah. So,
in the 1980s and 90s, Don Bluth and his team of animators changed animation forever. Although his animation studio was short-lived in comparison to Disney, it produced content that the world desperately needed. Some say that Don Bluth took on Disney and lost, because his films never achieved the same status as a Disney animated classic. But if we look at Don Bluth's ultimate goal, he didn't lose at all. He and his fellow animators proved what many thought was impossible. They struck out on their own and rivaled the biggest name in animation. His studio produced films that revived audiences' love of animation. He took risks that would have been heavily discouraged at Disney, producing films that challenged the public's idea of what a G or PG-rated animated film could be. Don Bluth wanted to push Disney to be its best by creating films that could compete with the animation juggernaut, both critically and commercially. And by doing so, he likely contributed to the studio's renaissance. But beyond that, the Don Bluth movies of the 80s and 90s raised a generation of animation lovers that hung on every frame. Every child of that era seems to have a favorite Bluth film, whether it's the ever-popular Land Before Time or the more obscure Rock-a-Doodle. But if you haven't found your favorite, give some of these titles a chance. Somewhere out there is a Don Bluth movie for everyone.
Oh, boy.
Very, oh my gosh. Nice.
Yeah, Rock-a-Doodle. We didn't even...
We did not get to that one.
We didn't list all of his movies, so we didn't list that one. Mm-hmm. But I mentioned it because I was obsessed with Rock-a-Doodle when I was a kid.
Yes, that was his life on the farm, right?
Yes. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
He would sing the song.
Oh, my gosh.
I kind of love the story of Don Bluth because it's one of those underdog tales where, you know, at the end of it, sure, the big, you know, the big studio still exists and kind of, you know, the small studios did eventually go under. But like we said a couple of times, they just, all it took was they proved it was possible.
Right.
Yeah.
They proved that the giant does bleed. You know, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because
David can hit Goliath.
Exactly. Yeah. Sure, Goliath didn't go down for the count.
But it was possible.
It inspired enough. And without it, Disney would have been the only thing around doing animation, probably.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't have been nearly as good.
I'm confident in saying that.
It's such a good thing that it happened.
Yeah.
Is it perfect? No.
Mm-hmm.
Is every movie great? No.
No.
As much as I want to say yes.
Yeah, I know.
Not really. But it's just something that means so much to the animation industry and to movies going forward that it's a staple of our childhood and
I
love it so much. Can't get enough.
Ones that I just remember watching as a kid. I mean, these were some of the ones that I got to watch. Besides, I do really wish I had been able to watch Thumbelina as a kid because I really think I would have loved that one.
Correct, yeah.
But An American Tale was definitely one that stuck with me. The music from it, the emotion. I mean, he just struck gold on like being able to give such emotions into these stories.
Yeah.
And he, in his book, he talks about how he struggled with that for a while. Like he really had to work at portraying emotions and everything in these drawings and these animations. And some of them, he just did so good.
Yeah.
So good.
There's a lot of emotion, a lot of character.
Mm-hmm.
And these movies have heartbreaking moments.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They were really good stories.
Yeah.
That otherwise might not have been turned into animated movies.
I mean, it really shows once again that the story is at the heart of it. If you don't have a good story, like no matter what the animation looks like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're not going to come back to it. You're not going to be like, oh, that was a great move. Like,
yeah. I think about, because, you know, they were working on The Rescuers and then they started doing their own thing.
Yeah.
The Woodpile Cat. And that was one of those things where they said they really started thinking about story when they were working on The Rescuers. And they wanted to make sure the story was so important because that movie does have a very touching story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it does have some of those, you can see it, the similarities are just like the tone and the sadness, the heaviness of, you know, this child who doesn't have anybody, you know, and just like the, she's in a very bad situation and, you know, all she's got are these two little mice that are trying to save her, you know? Yeah. Oh. And, you know, you can kind of see how, you know, they did have that influence before they broke off and made Secret of Nim.
And I remember reading somewhere that, you know, the story, Mrs. Brisby and the Rats of Nim was pitched at some point to Disney.
Yeah.
And they're like, no, nah, we've already got a mouse.
We've already got a mouse. Yeah, that's right.
So, well.
All right. Well, I think with that, we have a case closed.
All right.
Sweet. Yes. Oh, man.
Well done, everyone.
We are. And so while we wrap up here, we want to thank our patrons. We want to thank John, JD, Jacob, Anthony, Shelly, and Bob.
Thank you.
Thank all you, guys.
Right. Thank you so much.
Amazing. Yeah, everybody else, you can find us at blackcasediaries.com. You can find our patron if you want to become a patron. We would really appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. That'd
be
sweet.
You get some super cool stuff behind the, some behind the scenes stuff. You get some cool, yeah, extended episodes that you get to listen to us talk more. So if you want to do that.
Yeah, man.
It's there. So, all right. Bye.
Bye.
See ya.
My Fiver. I thought I would never see you again.
Never say never, Papa.